Speaker, Vice President Cheney, members of Congress, distinguished citizens and fellow citizens. Every year, by law and by custom, we meet here to consider the state of the Union. After recession, terrorist attacks, corporate scandals, and stock market declines, economic stagnation, and continued hardship, we can be confident. Our resolve is firm, and our union is strong. America's purpose is more than to follow a process. It is to achieve a man-made evil of international terrorism. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, W201ZD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What matters? What makes a good life? Do our central social institutions help us or hinder us in achieving it? Tonight on the program, wisdom from veteran educators John Taylor Gatto and Coleman McCarthy on teaching, learning, and peacemaking. Then some information on how you can participate in stopping a war.
From the widows and orphans, the never hard-working man I oppress. So take your pace easy, go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding my shiny black.
This is an article by John Taylor Gatto called What Really Matters. John Gatto is New York State Teacher of the Year and author of the best-selling Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. Gatto writes, "Going to the moon didn't really matter, it turned out. I say that from the vantage point of my 6 decades living on planet Earth, but also because of something I saw not so long ago. It was at Booker T. Washington High School where I watched an official astronaut, a handsome, well-built man in his prime, dressed in a silver spacesuit with an air of authentic command, try to get the attention of an auditorium full of Harlem teenagers. It was the Board of Education's perfect template for dramatic success. A distinguished black man leading ignorant black kids to wisdom. He came with every tricky device and visual aid NASA could muster, yet the young audience ignored him completely. I heard some teachers say, 'What do you expect from ghetto kids?' But I don't think that explained his failure at all. The kids instinctively perceived this astronaut had less control over his rocket vehicle than a bus driver has over his bus. I think they had also wordlessly deduced that any experiments he performed were someone else's idea. The space agency's hype was lost on them. This man, for all his excellence, was only some other man's agent. The kid sensed that his talk, too, had been written by someone else, that he was part of what the Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr called the non-thought of received ideas. It was irrelevant whether this astronaut understood the significance of his experiment or not. He was only an agent, not a principal. In the same way, many school teachers are only agents retailing someone else's orders. This astronaut wasn't walking his own talk, but someone else's. A machine can do that. It seems likely that my Harlem kids considered going to the moon a dumb game. Obviously, I didn't verify their feelings scientifically, but I knew a lot of them didn't have fathers or much dignity in their lives, and about half had never eaten off a tablecloth. What was going to the moon supposed to mean to them? If you asked me that question, I couldn't answer it with confidence, and I had a father once upon a time, and a tablecloth, too. If the truth were told, in my 30 years teaching in New York City, sometimes teaching prosperous white kids instead of Harlem kids, sometimes a mixed bag of middle-class kids, I never heard a single student, white or black, speak spontaneously of the U.S. space program. When the Challenger space shuttle blew up, there was a momentary flicker of curiosity. But even that passed in an instant. Going to the moon didn't matter, it turned out, though the government threw $100 billion into the effort. A lot of things don't matter that are supposed to. One of them is well-funded government schools. Saying that may be considered irresponsible by people who don't know the difference between schooling and education. But over 100 academic studies have tried to show any compelling connection between money and learning, and not one has succeeded. Right from the beginning, schoolmen told us that money would buy results, and we all believed it. So, between 1960 and 1992, the U.S. tripled the number of constant dollars given to schools. Yet, after 12,000 hours of government schooling, one out of five Americans can't read the directions on a medicine bottle. After 12,000 hours of compulsory training at the hands of nearly 100 government-certified men and women, many high school graduates have no skills to trade for an income, or even any skills with which to talk to each other. They can't change a flat, read a book, repair a faucet, install a light, follow directions for the use of a word processor, build a wall, make change reliably, be alone with themselves, or keep their marriages together. The situation is considerably worse than journalists have discerned. I know, because I lived in it for 30 years as a teacher. Last year at Southern Illinois University, I have a workshop in what the basic skills of a good life are as I understood them. Toward the end of it, a young man rose in back and shouted at me, "I'm 25 years old. I've lived a quarter of a century, and I don't know how to do anything except pass tests. If the fan belt on my car broke on a lonely road in a snowstorm, I'd freeze to death. Why have you done this to me?" He was right. I was the one who did it just as much as any other teacher who takes up the time young people need to find out what really matters. I did it innocently and desperately, trying to make a living and keep my dignity, but nevertheless, I did it by being an agent of a system whose purpose has little to do with what kids need to grow up right. My critic had 2 college degrees, it turned out, and his 2 degrees were shrieking at me that going to school doesn't matter very much, even if you get a good job. People who do very well in schools as we've conceived them have much more than their share of suicides, bad marriages, family problems, unstable friendships, feelings of meaninglessness, addictions, failures, heart bypasses that don't work, and general bad health. These things are very well documented, but most of us can intuit them without any need for verification. If schooling is something that hurts you, what on earth are we allowing it for? Does going to school matter if it uses up all the time you need to learn to build a house? If a 15-year-old kid was allowed to go to the Shelter Institute in Bath, Maine, he would be taught to build a beautiful post-and-beam Cape Cod home in 3 weeks, with all the math and calculations that entails. And if he stayed another 3 weeks, he'd learn how to install a sewer system, water, heat, and electric. If any American dream is universal, owning a home is it. But few government schools bother teaching you how to build one. Why is that? Everyone thinks a home matters. Does going to school matter if it uses up the time you need to start a business, learn to grow vegetables, to explore the world, or make a dress? Or if it takes away time to love your family? What matters in a good life? The things that matter in a bad life, we know, are gaining power over others, accumulating as much stuff as you can, getting revenge on your enemies, who are everywhere, and drugging yourself one way or another to forget the pain of not quite being human. School teaches most kids how to strive for a bad life and succeeds at this so well that most of our government machinery eventually falls into the hands of people who themselves are living bad lives. We're all in deep trouble because of that. It's the best reason I know to keep the machinery of government just as weak and as primitive as possible, as soon as we figure out how. It surprises me how many graduates leave college assuming they know what matters because they got straight A's. If we can believe advertisements, what matters to these people most is the personal ownership of machinery. Blending machines, cooking machines, driving machines, picture machines, sound machines, toothbrushing machines, computing machines, machines to kill insects, deliver intimacy, send messages through wires or the naked air, entertainment machines, shooting machines, and many more mechanical extensions of our physical self. Indirect control over even more ambitious machines seems to matter a lot. Flying machines, bombing machines, heart and lung machines, voting machines, and a great variety of other mechanical creations. All these devices are meant to defeat what would otherwise occur naturally if they didn't exist. They are all machines to beat human destiny and confer on human beings magical powers and the reach and longevity of gods. Do they deliver what they promise? Is human life, in a net sense, better since their advent? I can't answer that for you, of course, but you can look into your heart and answer the question for yourself. Someone has apparently convinced us that what occurs naturally cannot be the way to a good life, hence these battalions of machinery. What percentage of your life is spent talking to machines? Buying them, mastering them, ministering to their needs, then betraying them with ever newer and newer machine loves. It takes a lot of time, but what does it take a lot of time away from? Television has cost the average 21-year-old about 18,000 hours of time. What would that time have gone toward otherwise? Learning to build a house? Going to government-run school takes another 15,000 hours from the young life, 21,000 if you count going and coming and homework. What might this time have gone toward otherwise? From the very small amount of time remaining, machinery other than television gobbles a great deal. What does it give back in return? Heart's ease, love, courage? Self-reliance, friends, dreams? Here we are at the end of the 20th century, well-machined, yet lost in a tunnel of loneliness, cut off from each other, disliking ourselves, envying those with superior machines, looking for self-respect and significance. We have fewer and worse human ties than seems possible if machines justified all the time and money spent on them. I include, of course, the social machinery of school in this critique. From age 5 to age 21, there are exactly 140,160 hours. We spend 46,720 of them in sleep, and of the remaining 93,000 odd hours, 42% are spent watching TV from a chair or sitting in a school seat. Something's wrong here. What's going on? How much do these seemingly essential machines matter? What are they essential for? Each one taken separately can easily be justified, but taken all together, what are they doing to us? By mid-century, we'd reached a point in this machine civilization where we could so little bear intimate contact with the messy reality of living things, as compared to the clean simplicity of machines, that we became willing to lock up our mothers and fathers wholesale, to create a new investment opportunity in warehousing the old. What a strange thing to do with our unprecedented wealth, using it, that is, to divest ourselves of our closest human ties, getting rid of our history. In doing so, a complex circle begun a century earlier when we first locked our young people away in school warehouses is completed. Warehousing the young, warehousing the aged, good business, I know, but good for what? Does it really matter or not that our parents die among strangers and our children live penned up by strangers? Does that possibility have an effect on the quality of the lives neither old nor young who are left theoretically free of entanglements? Entanglements are, after all, the core of complete human lives. Good lives are all about being entangled with each other. The assertion that isolation chambers for the young and old are an advance in human society doesn't square with any observable reality. It, too, is part of the great non-thought of received ideas, like pretending a positive significance to the idiotic space program. After you fall into a habit of accepting what other people tell you to think, you lose the power to think for yourself. I suspect that's why so few of us challenge the premises of old age homes, television, daycare centers, and schools. Talking to machines as we have come to prefer to do does make us intimate with the way machines think. It also conceals from us the degree to which our own lives are mechanical and our own thoughts well controlled, like the thoughts of machinery. Have you ever noticed that machines don't ever surprise you after you know their habits? The purpose of market research is to remove surprise from human behavior, too. When we lose the power to surprise each other, we lose a chunk of what it means to be human. Would that matter? I want to argue that talking to machines when you should be talking to people in the natural world is what has clear-cut the Pacific forests, poisoned the fish in Puget Sound, weakened the soil up and down America, turned Cape Cod Bay into a dead sea, and burned holes in the stratosphere. Not a single one of those events would matter at all to machinery. And since machinery is what we have been most intimate with since early childhood, including social mechanisms like government schools, they don't matter to us either, regardless of what we say. If they mattered, we would stop it. At best, we're ambivalent. Who in his right mind would live without an automobile, a computer, a fax machine, a telephone, a toaster, lifelong schooling, or a gun? Everyone who winds life around a core of machinery like schools and institutions and global corporations is affected profoundly and comes inexorably, I believe, to be a servo mechanism of the machinery he or she excessively associates with. So far, I've asked you to consider three aspects of modern American life we've all been accustomed to think really matter. The space program, our well-funded government schooling, and state-of-the-art technology. On close inspection, all seem to me the obsessions of madmen more than essential parts of a good life or a good society. How did they come to matter when many things that really matter, like getting hugged a lot, are overlooked? In recent years, I've often heard that what really matters most is competing successfully in something called the global economy. Try to pass over the fact that all economies on Earth, every single one of them, including Japan's, are overwhelmingly national economies, or that the economies that seem to make people happiest and proudest are substantially local ones, and look at what you're being asked to believe. In effect, it's claimed that America's total self-sufficiency in food doesn't matter, that our embarrassing abundance of many fuels, fibers, metals, building materials, roads, technologies, libraries, colleges, talented labor, no longer matters decisively, because in some mysterious way we stand in grave danger of losing these things by becoming globally non-competitive. I will pass over the fact that with a standing army, navy, and air force of over 2.5 million men and women, a vast bombing fleet, an enormous arsenal of nuclear missiles, and a worldwide network of spies and saboteurs, it is really impossible to be non-competitive. And I will pass over our vast ability to manipulate money markets and currencies, which makes being non-competitive quite unlikely for all the foreseeable future. But I am puzzled by the rhetoric of global competition because we already possess abundantly all the essentials of a good material life, in-house, as it were. What will this global economy exist for if not to produce and distribute more material, develop more skill, more jobs, and more satisfaction, things out of which good lives are made? But these things are already here. I'm curious about the kind of human being who thinks this global economy matters, because it's clear to me they are caught up in a religious vision, a rather peculiar one, in which human nature is disregarded, along with the human needs which really matter, all of which needs are overwhelmingly small scale. It's easy to see how a global economy would matter to the spirit of mass production machinery or to international banking, with all the urgencies of those twin mechanisms, but not clear what the point of it is for flesh and blood. What if you forgot all about the globe and concentrated instead on your finding a place where you could feel at home for the rest of your life? What if you shaped your own work so that it served your spirit and the spirits of your loved ones, friends, and neighbors? In 1776, a full 90% of Americans not in slavery shaped their own work. They had independent livelihoods. And in 1840, despite the rise of industrialization, the figure was still 80%. It was hard then for any man to get rich on the labors of others, because there wasn't much free-floating labor to be had. People worked for themselves. That, liberty and independence, not wealth or comfort, was the American miracle. You know, machines can be stored anywhere, can function anywhere, and are indifferent to other machines they must associate with. But men and women have to build the meanings of their lives around a few, a very few people, to touch and love and care for. If you're always getting rid of people, trading them off the way you've been taught to trade off things, you can't have much of a life. And if you fail in this vital endeavor of linking up with the right people for you, it doesn't matter at all how healthy the space program is or how many machines you own. You'll still be lonely in the middle of crowds. If what I've said is even partially true, you'll have to join me in sabotaging the global economy and sabotaging the government schools, because schools and government and machinery makers lie to you about what matters every time. They just can't help themselves. And that was an article by John Taylor Gatto called What Really Matters. John Taylor Gatto is a former New York State Teacher of the Year and now a strong promoter of home-based learning. He's the author of Dumbing Us Down.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. Their speech is growing increasingly unkind. look like Jesus to me, and it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. They'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. You don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Where I'm poor and I become the enemy. Living in the wasteland of the free. We got little kids with guns fighting inner city wars. So what do? We put these little kids behind prison doors. We call ourselves the advanced civilization. That sounds like crap to me. Living in the wasteland of the free. We got high school kids running around in Calvin Klein and Guess, who cannot pass a sixth grade reading test. But if you ask them, they can tell you the name of every crotch on MTV. Living in the wasteland of the free. We kill for oil, then we throw a party when we win. Some guy refuses to fight, and we call that the sin. Yeah, he's standing up for what he believes in. That seems pretty damn American to me. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Where I'm poor and I've become the enemy. Let's blame our troubles on the weak one. Sounds like some kind of Hitler remedy. Living in the wasteland of the free. While we sit gloating in our greatness, justice is sent to the bottom of the sea. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free.
This is a recording of Coleman McCarthy describing Techniques of Peace and Conflict Resolution. He spoke at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 25, 2003. Coleman McCarthy is the founder of the Center for Teaching Peace. He teaches nonviolence at the Georgetown Law School, at public schools in Washington, D.C., and in prisons. He is currently teaching a course entitled Building Peaceable Schools at American University. He has also written and edited books about peace and nonviolence and has authored many columns and articles. In this workshop, McCarthy introduces the discipline of peace and conflict resolution, outlines a practical step-by-step process for resolving conflicts, and explores how our educational system leads us to lives as peace illiterates.
All right. This workshop is called Intro to Peace and Conflict Resolution, something like that. Colin McCarthy is a journalist who wrote columns for the Washington Post from 1969 to 1997. He is a pacifist, a vegetarian, an athlete who has run 18 marathons, including Boston and New York.
And I'm an orthopedic wreck, too.
Orthopedic wreck. He's an anarchist. He didn't say it, but he is.
Coming out today.
In addition to journalism, he is also a teacher. Since 1982, he has had more than 5,000 students, well, close to 6,000 now, right, students, in his courses on nonviolence and conflict resolution. He teaches at Georgetown Law School, the University of Maryland, American University, two high schools, and a prison. At American University, he has been twice voted Professor of the Year. How many times have you been fired?
We'll give you the details later.
Colin McCarthy is not a typical teacher. He does not give his students homework. He does not give tests or exams.
And that's
he
how you get to be Professor of the Year.
and he believes that grades are irrelevant. Instead, he believes in pure learning that is free of artificial rewards and pressures. In 1985, he founded the Center for Teaching Peace, which helps schools get peace studies programs into the curriculum. He is the author of 5 books on nonviolence, as well as editing 2 anthologies of peace essays. Hundreds of schools are using these as textbooks. Please welcome our old friend, Colin McCarthy.
Thank you, Andrew, for the warm welcome, and I do appreciate all the good organizing that you're doing with Emily and Maggie and the others. We either end up in this little world either agonizing or organizing, and the organizers are the ones we count on. And I do appreciate all the work you've done. It's a year-round project to get things underway. I want to talk to you briefly about a few of the issues with conflict resolution, conflict management, conflict elimination, and we'll have time for some questions and answers and disagreements and dissent. I do like people who disagree with me. I really have no choice in my line of work as a left-wing journalist. I get a stack of mail out high every week from readers around the country who call me a fool, jerk, know-nothing, ignoramus, idiot. And then I read my negative mail. So feel free to break in any time with the disagreement or dissent. Even though we may not see eye to eye on everything, we can always talk heart to heart. And that's what good debate's about, good discussion. And when people of goodwill come together, you have a good chance of moving ahead a little bit. Before we start, if you don't mind, if we can maybe take a moment of silence, reflection, prayer, if you believe in prayer, I'm sure many of you do. And let us remember for a brief moment or two all the people on this planet with whom we share the air, land, and water. The planet Earth, which was what Alfred North Whitehead, the great philosopher, once called a third-rate rock spinning around a second-rate fireball. Let's take a moment to remember all the people today who are victims of violence, whether economic violence, political violence, domestic violence, military violence. Let us remember our refugees. Let us remember our prisoners. Let us remember our slaves. Let us remember our people who are without homes, without luck, without friends, without hope. And all those who we know who are going through some tough times, maybe in our own lives. Let us remember, and remember the animals too, who are also victimized by violence every day. Let's take a moment to do that. All right, thank you very much for doing that. It's always good to do so. We sometimes get caught up in the rush of things and tend to forget some of the crucial ways people are victimized. And also, it's good to remember the good fortune many of us have, the blessings we have received. And if you are doing okay in this world, and I think many of you are, you have your health, you have good intellects, you have people who care about you, it's always good to remember that they came to us as gifts. Nobody makes it alone. And it's always important to show appreciation for what we've gotten. We always leave appreciation way too late. We let it go. Sometime write a letter to somebody to whom you owe a favor. That's true peacemaking. Or do a favor for somebody today for which they cannot thank you. That also is true peacemaking. Small ways. And the old saying goes, very few of us will ever do great things, but all of us can do small things in a great way. That's why it's good to come together to conferences like this. We can all value each other's gifts. Today I want to talk a little bit about how do we deal with conflicts in our lives, in our personal lives, our political lives, our academic lives. And we're not helpless to deal with those. The trouble is we don't teach you how to do it. Very few schools offer courses academically grounded in conflict resolution or conflict management. How many went to a high school where they offered you courses either in peace studies or conflict resolution? All former students of mine, I think. That's a good sign. The alums are showing up. And we have Nick and Dante from Wilson High, Dante and Nick organized the big protest at Wilson High last week. Much praise to them. So I want to run through a few of the basic steps how to deal with your conflicts. Conflict is a word, it's a neutral term. If someone says, oh, I like to avoid conflict, get them a one-way ticket to Mars, Jupiter, and or Neptune. One way, preferably. On this planet, we have conflict. It is a neutral term. When you break it down, all it really means is we need to change the way we're dealing with each other. That's all it means. And things are always in flux. Our lives change. Our commitments change. And so conflict is... it can be healthy. It's neither positive or negative. It depends whether you control the conflict or the conflict controls you. It's going to be one way or the other. So I want to run through a few of the basic steps that were taught by Gandhi, King, and many others, A.J. Musty, Dorothy Day. There are about 7 or 8 or 9 basic steps. And I want to run a few of those with you. Number one, in any conflict, define what this conflict is about. Think back to the Gulf War in 1991. You have two governments defining the conflict in a very different way. Saddam Hussein saw it as a property issue. We got to get back that land that the British gave to Kuwait in 1923. We didn't know what he was talking about because we don't know Middle East history. We don't need to know that. We're number one. It was a property issue for him. George Bush saw it first as oil. Got to get the oil coming. That didn't go over. We knew we had enough reserves. Then he switched. Then it was jobs. Oh, it means American jobs. And then he said, oh, we got to protect the emir of Kuwait. He's down to his last few billions. That didn't go over. Then he pulled out the classic line, America must stop naked aggression. That's always... You ever notice how it's always naked aggression? Never has any clothes on. It's always naked aggression. They always call it nude aggression. Really get into it. You had two governments defining the conflict in a very different way. You had two governments going like that. How can they solve it if they're defining it differently? You think back to your last conflict you had with somebody. Probably halfway through, you thought to yourself, what are we really fighting about? For A, it was this. For B, it was that. When you define, you clarify. When you clarify, you see. When you see, you can deal. Got to get through the fog. And then you can have a chance of reconciliation. But if you don't know what you're fighting about, a little difficult. Number two, in any conflict, it's never you against me. It's you and me against the problem. The problem is the problem. But we go into our conflicts mostly thinking, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm good, you're evildoer. Hear that phrase a little lately, the axis of evil, ah yes. That means we're good. I'm smart, you're dumb. I'm going to win, you're going to lose. You hear that rhetoric right now, don't you? Every day in the paper. Trouble with defeating somebody, the first thing they often think is, I got to get a rematch. And we have a rematch going on. The Gulf War is not going to begin next month, next week. It's going to escalate. It's been going on all along. I have a student in my class at School Without Walls, D.C. Public High School. And by the way, it's interesting. I've been teaching there for about 20 years as a volunteer. It's the closest school to the White House and one of the poorest schools in America. There's no cafeteria, no gym, no auditorium, no lockers, and no playing fields. Anybody go to a high school like that? I doubt it. It's 5 blocks away from power. And 5 blocks the other way on G Street is the Watergate. You got the millionaires down there and you got the power brokers here. And then be Phoenix little schoolhouse. Good scrappy kids go there though. They know the odds are against them, so they work twice as hard. One of my students there is a young senior girl, 18 years old, from Baghdad, Iraq. Her father was a political prisoner held in Iraq's prisons by the Hussein dictatorship, locked up during the 1980s because he opposed the Iran war, or the Iran-Iraq war that Saddam Hussein was waging, supported by the United States, and where he bought weapons from a little company in Rockville, Maryland, and Ohio. They locked her up, locked the father up. This girl was born in the prison because her mother was a prisoner also. Father came home late 1990, a few months later, in a little town south of Baghdad called Najaf. The Americans bombed the town, tried to kill this child and her family. They fled as refugees, walked 200 miles south to the Saudi border where they were locked up in a refugee camp for 60 years. And while on the walk on the highway of death, the Iraqi Republican Guard were getting bounties to kill refugees. They tried to kill this family. She had two governments tried to kill her. Amazing story. She's doing okay now, but she tells it like few people know. They have two governments try to kill her. All because they have different agendas. And the refugees are caught in the middle. So think about it. We have common problems with Iraq. We have common problems with every country on this planet, with every government. We all have poverty. We all have famines. We all have people out of work. We all have mentally ill people. It's not you against me. Well, we tend to think that way because we have of this win-lose attitude in this country, and many other countries also. Number three, in any relationship, whether among governments or among your friends or families, list your shared concerns as against your unshared separation. What are your shared concerns? Well, the ordinary things. You may have the same dormitory, same collars, same house, same bedroom, same refrigerator, same car, same assets. Those are still there. They haven't been destroyed by the one issue that separates you. If you focus on what separates you, you're probably going to separate more. You're going to go like that. You keep thinking about it. You get angry about it. It can be the ordinary things, as we said. Are the things you've shared all along and which brought you together in the first place. That's why friendships form, relationships, marriages. That's why treaties are signed among governments. We can get along better together. It's what Kropotkin, the great Russian pacifist and anarchist, said in that classic text called Mutual Aid. We're all united. Well, we tend to get a little nervous when someone takes a little bit more than they need and do a little of that. But the assets are always there. With your conflict partners, you do not have husbands, wives, friends. You have conflict partners. And those of you who are sweethearts, tomorrow morning wake up and say, good morning, a conflict partner, can I get breakfast for you? A little cold and clinical, but that's all we are. A study done recently by the American Psychological Association has found out that the average American family has a conflict every 8 minutes. And those are the functional families. Forget about the rest, Kinky. That's just an ongoing war zone there. And it happens. The leading cause of injury among American women, you know what it is, it's being beaten up at home by husband, boyfriend, ex-husband, ex-boyfriend. It's often family violence where the conflict's the worst. You can have opinions about how to deal with Iraq or deal with Bush or deal with all these tyrants or the folks you're living with. It's a dirty little secret of the peace movement. And that many of the great peacemakers were wretched people at home. Gandhi was a cruel husband and father. Tolstoy, 13 children, hardly knew their names. King was not a particularly good husband. His mind was elsewhere with his kids. Didn't pay much heed to his kids. Einstein was cruel to his wives. Why is that? Gandhi had four sons. The oldest son was so angry at his father, always off saving the world, giving speeches, this celebrated father. He said, someday I'm going to get even with him. And someday he did. Got to be in his early 20s. Guess what he did? Joined the army. And that did get to Gandhi, too. They were never reconciled. And the son later acquired the disease of alcoholism and became a prostitute. Gandhi's son. Never reconciled. A Gandhi quarrel with his brother, who thought that Gandhi ought to make a lot of money from doing this peace stuff and give it to his brother. Tolstoy. He made his wife copy over by longhand 7 drafts of Anna Karenina in longhand. I think you have 2 or 3 drafts, you kind of got the idea what the book was about. And then you turn around, you have someone like a great family man, Harry Truman. Loved his wife, never looked at another woman. He loved his daughter, Margaret. I got to know her pretty well over the years. And she always told me how much her father, Harry Truman, idolized Bess Truman. Yet there's the great family man. What'd he do? He dropped 2 bombs on Japanese families. So it's always good to keep in mind who you're living with. I think the most revolutionary thing anybody can do is to raise good and decent and honest and non-violent children. If you do that, you are a true revolutionary. Because the culture goes against you. There's that old line from T.S. Eliot. I was reading a play of his the other night. Line jumped out. In a world of fugitives, those who run in the opposite way are labeled as mad ones. We live in a fugitive culture. If you commit your life to peacemaking, peace building, you looked a little bit odd. That's why it's very good to come to a conference like this. We can all feel odd together. That's why I became a journalist. It was always my goal, still is my goal. And I have a piece tomorrow morning in the LA Times about that Iraqi student of mine. It's always been my goal to make the abnormal look normal. It shouldn't be abnormal to have housing for everybody. It shouldn't be abnormal to have enough food for everybody. That's normal. So list your shared concerns. And do this before the conflict starts with your roommate, your teammates, your partners, your lovers, your husbands or wives. Sit down in moments of calm and say, these are all our assets. Let's not overlook it. Number 4, when people have fought or they've quarreled, never ask them what happened. Because you're going to get back a version of what happened. And we tend to give very self-serving versions of what happened. We're right and they're wrong. They're evil doers, you hear that? Rather, instead of asking what happened, ask what did you do. Then you get back specifics. When you ask what happened, you get back opinion. Oscar Wilde said, you can argue opinion, but it's difficult to argue fact. I teach at Georgetown Law School a course called Law, Conscience, and Nonviolence. And there we have a course called Pretrial Discovery, where the lawyers are taught how to settle cases before they get to trial. You may remember the O.J. Simpson trial. You may not have liked those egomaniac lawyers, but they were talented people. They were the best. And they kept asking, what did you do at 10:35? What did you do at 11:05? They were building the case on fact. Because then you clarify, like defining. That's crucial. So ask people, what did you do? And then you get closer to the truth. Number 5, work on active listening rather than passive hearing. Big difference. If you are a good listener, you have many friends. If you are a poor listener, you have many acquaintances. Big difference. Listening is an act of caring. Last thing I say before I walk into my classes, I say, listen well to your students. That's the first thing students want to know about their teachers. Is this going to be a listener, or is it one more in a long list of blowhards and gas bags? Students want to know right away, am I going to be talked at this whole semester? If you're in a class like that, walk out. They're wasting your time. And sometimes you got to let people talk on and on. That's okay. We all want to be listened to. Ernest Hemingway wrote that great novel. Hemingway, I wouldn't exactly call him a model of nonviolence. But he had his good days. And on many of his good days, he wrote that wonderful book, A Farewell to Arms, where really the most soulful of his novels. The other novels, he's either out beating his chest or out beating up on fish. All your English majors know that. In Farewell to Arms, he had a great line. He described a character, probably the purest line he ever wrote. He was strong in the broken places. All of us have been, are, or will be broken by life. It happens. But if you're strong in that place, or if your relationship is strong there, you have a good chance of surviving. It's important to keep that in mind, because we tend to get, oh, I'm not going to make it. Over the years, I've had many students who've had some tough times. I've lost about 6 to suicides. And you always wonder, could I have done anything different? You always try to look, sometimes you don't notice the signs are so obvious. And you always say, I should have known. There's two things you can do if you have some friends that are going through some hard times, and all of us do, maybe right now, who knows. You can do a couple things. You can tell your friends who are climbing the hills, and no matter how tough a time you're going through, somebody else has had that same pain and has made it. They overcame it. Nobody has any pain that's ever unique to only them, even though it may seem that way. But other people are going through the same anguish. And number two, if you're going through that tough time, call up somebody and tell them, or write to them, or contact them. Listen, I don't think I'm going to make it. I'm just in despair. Call up somebody. And tell your friends, if you're having a tough time, call me. We can figure something out. Depression is very difficult. But we're not alone. Number
six.
You're number six?
Yep.
You're keeping track. All right. Are you a mathematician or?
English major.
English major. We love the English majors. All right. Number six we're on. Number six is work on something that's doable. Often when you have a conflict or separation or a fight or quarrel or argument, spat, call it what you want, you often want to get it back together right away. You can't get it back to right away. It took a long time to break up. I work a lot with divorce lawyers, and I spoke to one recently, and the lawyer was representing one side against the other, and the marriage came apart, and I asked the lawyer, do you remember when the first break in the relationship occurred? He said, yeah, we always find out sooner or later. It had to be one moment. Every fire starts with one little lick of flame. Every breakup occurs at one point. And he told a story. The couple they've been married a few years, and they're having a dinner for their friends. They invite some couples over. And it was the wife's turn to cook that week, so she spent all day in the kitchen and getting everything going to be a great dinner for everybody, and she wanted to really serve a wonderful soup, get everybody off to a good start with the meal. So she gets all the seasoning in, stirs it up, and really, really devotes a lot of time to that soup. So the couples come over, they bring out the soup, and everybody starts sipping away. The husband takes his first sip, He grabs his throat. Ugh. This soup has too much salt in it. Well, it wounded the wife. It just humiliated her. And he goes on and on, and he pushes the soup back. That's too much salt in there. Well, the next day, the wife let it go, didn't say anything. The next day, she let him have it back where he was vulnerable. And all couples know where the other one's vulnerable is vulnerable or hurtable. We all know. And she let him have it where she knew it would hurt him. And that's where the split began. And then it escalated. What's the solution? Swallow the salty soup and shut up. Who cares?
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to Colin McCarthy speaking on Techniques of Peace and Conflict Resolution.
A lot of people think divorces happen over big issues. The husband runs off with Meryl Streep to go look at Paris in the springtime. Or the wife runs off with Robert Redford to go whisper to horses out in the big sky country. It's never that big. It's usually the soup or the salt. Or one of the couples comes home late from work every day. Sends a message, I'll get there when I feel like it. That hurts after a while. You can leave work and get home early on time. It sends a message, I care about you. It's little small messages that add up. And then you have a compatible relationship. And happiness results. You can't have a happy marriage. You can only have a compatible marriage. And happiness is the result of that. Just like peace is the result of love. And if love was easy, we'd all be good at it. And we'd be good at it if we knew how to deal with our basic conflicts. So that's work on what is doable. Figure out what you can do to get it back. Make a gesture unilaterally. We could be doing this internationally with all these governments. And by the way, there are, by latest count, there are 59 wars or conflicts in the world. 59 wars or conflicts. 40,000 people a month on average being killed in those wars. Almost always the poor killing the poor. That's all wars are. Only one member of Congress during the Vietnam War had a son who saw combat. Only one. I think there's only two in the military now. The children are members of Congress. Number 7, are we on now? All right, thank you for keeping count. All right. You got to choose the place where you deal with your conflicts. You ever wonder why armies always sign treaties far away from the battlefield? Got to get away from where the gore and the hate was. Does anybody know where the treaty for the American Revolution was signed? Paris. Paris. Of course, Ben Franklin liked to go to Paris anyway to visit his mistresses, so a little extra there for history majors. I work a lot with elementary schools. I was out to one in Minnesota recently right near Carleton College in St. Olaf in Northfield, Minnesota. Anybody go to either of those schools? No? Wonderful little college town. And some of the farming families and professors started to have their own little school. We want to do it ourselves, educate our kids. And they had the architect build a peace room. Peace room. And I went to the school, looked around, and I said, what goes on in the peace room? Oh, every Friday between 9 and 12, anybody who had a conflict automatically knows to go to the peace room. And I said, who's there? Well, we have 8 grades in the class, and we have 8 mediators. Every class elects a mediator. And the little kiddies, they have this being enlightened Minnesota. Well, the politics are so enlightened until Jesse Ventura came along. The little kiddies, they love to run for office. They have little PAC committees, and they have speech writers and campaign slogans and signs, and they have little buttons. I said, one little kid wearing a button said, wearing buttons is not enough. Everybody get that one? All right. And so there it was. So I said, what happens when you go in? Well, the kids know these 9 steps to conflict resolution, and they apply it. And the kids are empowered. No adults are in the room. You can teach them how to do it. And so the kids have gotten so good at it that now the faculty bring their fights every Friday morning. I told the kids, charge $200 an hour, make a buck off this. The kids can do it. Teach them everything else. Yes?
I just want to say that you can do it even younger. I worked in a child care center, and 2-year-olds can do it, 4-year-olds can do it really well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Why not? That's a great age, Montessori. That's the ideal age. One of my former students, Sarah Kopp, over there, went to AU and had my class at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School. She's now a first grade teacher. And I do admire her. Sarah Kopp, right there. Yes. Yes, she is. I do admire elementary school teachers way much more than college professors. Let's get this one right, okay? The college, while we walk around with our briefcases, got TAs to do all the dirty work for us. And let me tell you, college professors, we don't do runny noses, as Sarah does. We don't find lost raincoats. Anybody in college, yeah? You ever have a prof come up? Well, I'll take care of your runny nose for you. The elementary school, they do it. And 80% of our character is formed by age 8. And they do it in early grades. If you're thinking about teaching, we need you in the grade schools. I would do it, but I don't have enough courage. I do admire that. Is anybody thinking of going into teaching? Do you? Now think about the elementary schools. That's where it's desperately needed. I got a couple chapters in this book about elementary school teachers, particularly black elementary school teachers. There's only about 7 or 8 in all of D.C. And those kids are looking for role models. I work with D.C. elementary schools to get the teachers to teach this kind of stuff. So if you work in Northfield, have a peace room. When you have a family, have a peace table. So when you raise your kids, you know. In this household, when we have a disagreement, we don't slam doors, we don't run out, we don't hit each other, we sit down at the table. We're on 8 now?
Yes.
Number 8? All right.
Ready for that one.
All right. Work on your forgiveness skills. That's crucial. We all get wounded, we all get hurt. If you know how to forgive, you tend to be a rather liberated person. Liberated from what? From the garbage of the last fight. Martin Luther King gave one of his first Sunday sermons on forgiveness. It was in December 1957 at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, where I visited a few years ago. And it was a great sermon on forgiveness. It was called Loving Your Enemies. And he said, forgiveness is not just a theological virtue, it is a practical skill. It lets you leave it behind you. Forgiveness looks forward. Hatred looks backwards. You ever wonder why we have eyes in front of our head, not in the back? We're supposed to look forward. In that same church, 22 years later, almost to the day, 1979, someone came in that same little church, unwanted, unannounced, unliked, and emphatically unwelcomed. Who was that? It was Governor George Wallace, a segregationist governor. of Alabama. He was in a wheelchair because he was nearly killed in 1972 up in Laurel, Maryland. Shot by someone to kill him. But severed his spinal cord, so he never walked again. But he was alive and healthy that day when he came in the church. They wheeled him up to the microphone. Everybody stopped when they saw him come in. What's he doing here? Of all people. The music stopped, praying stopped. Total silence. He took the microphone and said, "Please forgive me for interrupting you. I came to ask you a question. I did evil things to you, hateful things. I willed it. I wanted to hurt you, both personally and politically. I've come to tell you I'm sorry. I repent. I want you to forgive me. I beg you. Please forgive me." Everybody stopped looking around. No one said anything. A minute goes by, 2 minutes. Finally, an elderly deacon in the back row with a booming voice jumps up and says, "Brother Wallace, you consider yourself forgiven." Everybody started clapping and praying, jumping up and down, singing their songs. It was a great day, I think. If it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. He later went to the 35th anniversary of the Selma Montgomery March with Joe Lowery, Jesse Jackson, many. Rosa Parks was there, big crowd. And again, he asked to be forgiven. So that takes a bit of courage to do that. And he later died about 2 or 3 years later, but I think he went out a redeemed person. It's hard to tell, but I think that was a great day in our history. We've had a few presidents who've done that. We had Clinton went down to, remember, Nicaragua a few years ago, I think he did, and or no, Guatemala he went to. And he asked the Guatemalan people to forgive the U.S. for what we did, sending all those weapons all those years. It was a good gesture, but as often happened with Clinton, it tended to be a little bit hollow. Because about a year later, he lifted the arms sales ban against weapons to Latin America. So we're now selling weapons again to Latin American governments. Gorbachev, who I thought had many great virtues, he asked the Afghanistan people for their forgiveness. A couple years after that war ended, when we were supplying weapons to our good brother Bin Laden, he was on the CIA payroll, making more than we paid our president. Gorbachev came to Washington, as you know, in the late 1980s, right at the height of Glasnost, when the thaw was beginning between Soviet and U.S. relations. He was in a motorcade downtown, right during noon hour, right near the, I think, 18th in Pennsylvania, down that way, and jumps out of his car. A big crowd gathers around, and there's Gorbachev, a real live communist, right in Pennsylvania Avenue. Hey, my God, gee, everybody's nervous. A reporter was there, and I said, "What'd you get out of the car for?" And he said, an interpreter, he said, "We Soviets are about to do something awful to you Americans. We're going to deny you an enemy." On the great lines. Well, we quickly found Fidel Castro, and we got Muammar Gaddafi and Noriega. We got a long list of people to hate. We got Saddam Hussein now. We have this this almost insatiable need to have an enemy, an evildoer. Carl Jung wrote about that, the great Swiss psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. And so nations are like people. They all carry around a little shadow inside them that they don't want to deal with it themselves, so they project the evil out there. They don't want to deal with their own flaws or their own crimes or their own sins. Let's project it outward. rather than dealing with an inward. So that's forgiveness. A lot of people are very large-minded on the surface. Oh, yes, I forgive you, and I'm willing to bury the hatchet. But then we say to ourselves in a whisper, I'm going to mark exactly where I buried the hatchet, just in case I got to dig it up again for the next fight. You're not free yet. Number nine, and we'll stop, take a few questions and answers, that work on how to purify your heart. That means, that's just a fancy phrase for fix up your own mess of your life before you tell me what a mess I'm in. How do you do it? Well, you simplify your life. And you work on your own flaws. First, sends a message. There's that great story, which I'm sure you've all heard many times, about Gandhi. And Gandhi was in the ashram one day. A mother comes from a distant village with her little boy, and she walked all day to get there. Hot summer day, she was exhausted. Goes to the ashram. There's Gandhi underneath a big banyan tree, saying his Hindu prayer book. He prayed every day. And she goes up to him and says, Gandhi, excuse me, but if I just interrupt you for a moment, I walked all day to visit with you. I brought my little boy with me. I'm having a lot of trouble with him. He's always eating sugar. And I tell him to stop because it's bad for his health. But he won't listen to me, Gandhi, but I think he'll listen to you because you're his hero. Little boy, 6 or 7, loved Gandhi. So Gandhi ponders a moment and looks at the little boy and the mother and says, come back in 1 week. Well, the mother said, all right, I got to walk all the way back again. She's a little upset. Okay, she says, walks, gets up and goes, takes the little boy. A week later, walks all the way back again. Again, she's exhausted. And there's Gandhi underneath the same tree saying his Hindu prayer book. And she goes up to him and says, Gandhi, do you remember us? Oh, yes, of course I do. You're the mother with little boys always eating sugar. And he asked me to tell him to stop because it's bad for his health. She says, that's right. Will you please do it now? Gandhi turns to the little boy and says, young person, I want you to stop eating sugar because it's bad for your health. So the mother jumps up. Oh, Gandhi, oh, what a great day this is. Oh, he's always going to be healthy now, thanks to you. He's going to obey you. And she hugs him and she kisses him and goes like that. Hindus love to go like that, get a little extra. And he's up to leave and goes to the gate, and turns around and says, Gandhi, I don't mean to be rude to you. I know you're one of the greats, great peacemaker. You get wonderful press clippings endlessly. Why didn't you? Why'd you make us walk back here? Why'd you tell him a week ago when we were here? He turns to her and says, good mother, until 1 week ago, I was eating sugar. There's the great Gandhi, still working on himself. And it was late 70s. Get the metaphorical sugar out of your life before you tell anybody else to stop doing it. How do you do it? The easiest way to begin is to figure out the difference between what you want and what you need. Because we raise you to want things in this country. Advertising is built on arousing your want desires rather than your need basics. Yeah, we buy into it. You know the old line. Mother Teresa used it often. I interviewed Mother Teresa many times. She's very difficult to interview. You'd be talking to her. And she's kind of in a little small size. And she'd go along in a very, very quiet voice, and you'd be listening to her, kind of listening in. And without any warning, she'd go, love God! Love God. I said, Mother, keep your hands down. You're gonna hurt somebody when you go like that. And that was a digression. Who's watching? All right. She once said, she said a lot of things. I don't know whether half the lines were hers or not, but she had a great speechwriter. Live simply so others may simply live. I'm sure you've seen that one. It's all over the place. That's what you got to do. Figure out the difference between what you need and what you want. And then you're liberated, pretty much. How do you go about it? Well, don't support the meat industry. Don't support the dairy industry, the egg industry, the alcohol industry, the tobacco industry. Don't support the corporate media, especially not them. Get your news from the small magazine, the Progressive, the Sojourners, the Nation, all the Peaceworks from the American Friends Service Committee. Don't rely on General Electric or Tom Brokaw to tell you what's going on, because they don't tell you. Nor the Washington, a pest. Everybody get that one? All right. Explain that to the slow ones, would you? All right, very good. By the way, on the Post, I used to work there. I still write for the paper. There are many good reporters there. But keep in mind, there's no liberal media in this country, not the mainstream media. There are a few liberal reporters, maybe, but they're only as liberal as the conservative owners will let them be. You don't get the full story. I monitored the Post op-ed page last year for 3 months, May, June, and July. And during that time, they ran on the op-ed page 432 columns. Less than 30 were by women. Less than 10 were by blacks outside the paper. Less than 10 were by certifiable people on the left. That to me is dishonest. Because it says, very few women have enough to say that we're going to print them. That's not true. Very few blacks have anything to say. That's not true. And very few on the left have anything to say. That's dishonest also. So don't give me money. And that's how you really vote. It's not about elections. And not to be cynical, but if voting could change things, they'd make it illegal. Gandhi got the idea from simple living from Henry David Thoreau. Gandhi admired Thoreau very much, and Thoreau got the idea from simple living from the Greeks. Thoreau went to Harvard College, graduated in 1836, and he majored in Greek. Not many people know that about Thoreau. All right. And his favorite... he read Homer also. Homer never made much money from his writing. He lived rather simply. But he was an agitator. And when Homer died, Aristophanes wrote a little two-line poem, which Thoreau loved to quote. See if I remember it. Seven Grecian cities begged for Homer dead, through which the living Homer had begged his bread. In other words, you always won the greats when you're safely dead. But when you're alive, get out of town, we don't want to see you. You saw that with Dorothy Day. As soon as Dorothy was dead, oh, let's canonize Dorothy, said Cardinal O'Connor, the military chaplain in front of whose church Dorothy used to picket during the Vietnam. Let's make her a saint now and make her irrelevant. And Socrates also had a great line about simple living. He said, I love to walk through the marketplace and see all the things I can live without. I think we ought to put that sign over every shopping mall in America and solve a lot of credit card problems real quick. So those are the nine basic steps to conflict resolution. Do they always work every time? They do not. Sometimes the fire is out of control. It's just got to burn itself out. You got to do prevention before rather than intervention after. We tend to be afterward interveners. That's what prisons are for. That's what wars are about. The smart folks do prevention before with nonviolence, rather than intervention after with violence. Because clearly violence has failed. Otherwise, we'd have had peace a long time ago if violence worked. But one more time, it will work. We have this extraordinary faith in violent solutions. So we have time for a few questions and answers and disagreements and dissent. And yes, sir, tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is John, and I'm a high school math teacher from Richmond.
Are you?
Yes.
Do you like math?
Yes, I do.
All right, what do you like about it?
It's very logical, straightforward.
How much math do you really need after the eighth grade?
It depends on what you're going to do with it.
Right?
Most people probably will not use algebra in their daily lives. They will use geometry if they're doing home improvement projects or something like that. But
so why do we call it home improvement? I take off home improvement. Should we do that? Maybe a little subspecialty of geometry.
I think the reason why I still feel good about teaching it is because it's one way to improve thinking skills. In other words, if I had never taken math in school, I would not have been able to start breaking down arguments. 1, 2, 3, A, B, C, 4, A, and B, and then 5.
All right.
But
pay attention to subtleties.
Exactly. All right.
Right. But I did have a question.
Yes.
We digress.
Yeah, how do you respond to people who say, after all of this, there's evil in the world, and you have to deal with it somehow?
Sure. I go among people who society labels evil. I've been working with death row inmates for a long time, and I worked on a death penalty case for about 20 years in Virginia. And I would take my classes down to death row to spend the whole day, high school class from BCC and here at American. And I had a friend there for a number of years. And before we go down, everybody's kind of a little nervous about going into death row. And but gee, they might kill us when we're in there. And so a few of the Republicans didn't want to go on the trip, of course, so we took them along. And we spend the day talking with the men, the evil people, the heinous people, and soon find out that they're pretty much just like us, except they did kill. But I often wonder, why do we define them by the worst things I've ever done in their life? We tend to do that about people who are on death row, whereas very few of us are defined by the worst things we've ever done. We don't define ourselves that way, nor define anybody else. Let me ask a question, if I may. How many of you can raise your hand and tell everybody else in this room, in all absolute honesty, I've never ever cheated in school? One hand, two hands, all right, three or four. Everybody else kind of averting our gaze now, looking down. We've all cheated. Not everybody, but and why do we do it? Because we're evil or because we're afraid?
Afraid.
We do it out of fear. And so you have two types of learning in our schools. You have fear-based learning, and then you have desire-based learning. That's why I happen to think that grades, homework, and tests are all forms of academic violence. Everybody like that little theory? All right. Now we're getting somewhere. And the point we are laboriously getting to is that nobody's born evil. It's a learned behavior. Yeah, it can go either way. If you tend to come, almost everybody in death row I've ever interviewed came from highly dysfunctional families. They saw violence at home. Hey, that's the way the world works. I better get good at that too. And you're around death, violence, killing someone doesn't mean too much. And almost all homicides are panic related, they're drug related. Very few are well planned. Some are. The snipers, that was a well planned. That was a rare exception. So I don't think anybody's born evil. It's a learned behavior. Now you can debate that. There's a big debate about that. But when Bush goes around demonizing people, and we tend to demonize people we disagree with, you can't do it. You don't get the dialogue. I do know that the men on death row, they were not evil people. In fact, they were some of the best students I've ever had. I organized a course for men on death row to read the literature piece, and they'd write essays for me. And they had pure desire-based learning. That's the purest kind you can learn. We teach our students by fear. Do it or else. Or I'll flunk you. And you end up homeless in 10 years. We scare the wits out of the kids. That's the way to teach. Yes?
Yeah, how would you apply this mindset paradigm to the situation in Iraq?
We would do exactly what our good Republican leader Ronald Reagan did 1987-88 after he called the Soviet Union the evil empire and the focus of evil in the modern world. He got on an airplane, went to Russia, and now Russia is our ally. Very few thought that would ever happen. I had a student here at American University when I taught him in the mid-1980s. We had a big class right in Ward Circle 1, and there was one boy in the class who was an arch conservative. He loved Ronald Reagan. He wanted to triple the military budget. He wanted to get a missile base right here in the Quad. Because he knew the Soviets were coming any minute. And he took my class. And he was a nice lad. I always loved the right wing, just for diversity. And he sat in the front row. He'd come in the class. He'd pop Advil to get through the class. He'd have maybe a little Librium here and there. At the end of the class, he walks up. Everybody's leaving. Last day of class, he walks up to me. He says, "You know, Professor, I heard you babble away this whole semester on the glories and the beauties of nonviolence. And I, oh, God, you know, it was agonizing how you talk like that. I'll make a little deal with you, though. I will become a pacifist." This was high of the Cold War, 1986, high of the Cold War. "I'll make a little deal with you. I promise you. I will become a pacifist the day the Soviet Union falls without a Third World War." Well, the last I heard, that boy's running a craft shop in Vermont. It happened. Where did Nixon go to take on the godless atheist Chinese commies? He went to Peking or Beijing and talked to the Chinese commies. And what did they do? They sent him home with a bag of ping pong balls and two pandas. And now they're trading with us. Hey, get on the plane and go talk to Saddam Hussein and deal with him.
Yes.
But he said, "Oh, no, no, he's beyond, he's evil." When you demonize, when you have a monologue of hate, you can't have a dialogue of reconciliation. We're having a monologue of hate right now. And he gives it right back. You got two mad men, that little girl of mine at the school, she's caught in the middle. You got to go talk to people. And deal. Yes, sir. Tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Joe. I'm from Mary Washington College.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Nice.
What you're talking about, I actually thought I'm asking this. We, at the school, the progressive community has been having sort of conflicts with the Republicans here. Not something crazy or physical, but basically, it's for those people who are involved in politics and don't care, like 2% of the college, it's kind of divided into two camps that have become more and more hostile to one another.
Yeah.
And the thing is, we realize, though, we can't really get anything done. I mean, we can obviously have events and try to get people. We have gotten a lot of support from college, more and more students are getting open on the hall. But we don't feel like we can really have anything constructive until there's some kind of dialogue between the two groups.
Yeah.
At the same time, I mean, we're having a lot of trouble doing that because everything, I mean, if I try to talk to them, myself or my friends do, or, I mean, we stand on two opposite ends of the spectrum. And I don't know if any of you guys know anything about Mary Washington Republicans, but they are really, really, really conservative people. And
yeah.
I mean, one guy publicly declared, I want to go kill Iraqis.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't know, just ask me if you might have some advice on that.
Well, I don't think anybody is beyond... That'd be nice.
I am?
Good. Yeah, some people seem to be beyond reaching out to, and who knows what they're going through. Maybe you can't get to them. You got to be realistic.
Okay, we're trying to, following Hampshire College's lead, we're trying to draft an official stance out against the war in Iraq, and I wonder if, like, to have our institution represent that. We're having some problems with the administration. I wondered if you had any advice to give us as to how we should deal with that or what we should say.
Is there a peace studies degree program in Antioch?
Yes, there is.
Is there?
Jim Key.
Yeah, very good. That's a good start. You're way ahead of most schools. There's only 70 colleges in America with a degree program in peace studies.
We also don't do grades.
Yeah. I hold your score high. It's a good score. No, it's a good score. This fire's out of control right now. What you got to figure out now in your own personal lives, your political lives, what can I do now that maybe will stop wars happening in the year 2012 or 2030? What can you do in your own life now to make sure you have friendly relationships when you're 30 or 40 in your life? We tend not to look that far ahead. But the Iraq war didn't start just yesterday with Bush. It began a long time ago. There's little wars that are beginning right now which will be erupting 10, 20, 30 years. Look at El Salvador. That started back in the 1930s. And Carter, the great Nobel laureate, don't believe it. I remember Oscar Romero wrote to Carter in 1979 and said, we have some trouble down here in El Salvador, but don't send us any weapons. I beg you, don't send weapons. And what did Carter say? Oh, we know what's best for you. And began sending weapons to El Salvador. You know what happened. It's like you're the mother or father of a couple of kiddies at home, and you walk in the living room, you come home afternoon, and you got two of the kids playing with little toys. And one of the kids wants to control the toys, so the other one won't have them. So a little fight starts, and you're the wise parent, and you look at the little kiddies. Oh, my heavens, children, I see a little fight erupted here, hey? I know what to do. Here's a gun for you, and there's a gun for you. I'll come back an hour later, see how you're doing. You come back an hour later, there's blood everywhere in the walls, ceilings, so they get bullet holes, but they're still alive somehow. No, that's my toy. No, it's not, it's my toy. You're the all-wise parent. My kitty's still fighting, hey? I know what to do. Here's a bigger gun for you. There's a bigger gun for you. That's El Salvador, it's Indonesia. What are we doing to stop the U.S. from being the number one arms dealer? That's hard to work on, but pick out one issue. This town, Washington, is full of issue dropouts. They get excited about freeing the whales 1 year, and then daycare reform the next year, and then saving the redwoods, and then anti-war. They're cause jumpers. They get all caught up with the thrill of the new cause. But it's very hard to find folks to stay at it year after year after year after year and keep on doing it. I hold those folks good and high. So pick out what your cause is, what interest you have, and dig in. And do not worry about being successful worry about being faithful, and then you got it. Let me just give you one quick on what we call the five E's. Whenever anybody does something we don't get, we don't know what happened, we always say, why did they do that? Whether it's good or evil what they've done. There are five E's that all of us are involved with. And if you know the five E's about somebody, it almost always helps explain why they did what they did. First is ego, their education, their emotions, their environment, your experiences. Just one example of many out of this. How many of you in your family are the oldest of the children? Oh, we got a few oldest. How many of you are the youngest? Got a few youngest. How many are onlys? All right, how many in there mixed up, don't quite know where you are? All right. There are some combinations which are ideal for marriage and some are absolutely disastrous. I urge you, when you start dating and fall in love, make sure you ask, what's your family position? Because some combinations are ideal and some you're guaranteed for the divorce court. I lucked out. I've been married 35 years. We're doing fine. It worked out well with us. My wife was the oldest girl, and she had all younger brothers. So she grew up ordering her young, dumb brothers around and do this, do that. You know what you're doing. I was the youngest of four brothers, so I grew up taking orders all my life. So I don't mind being ordered around by my wife. She likes to give orders. We get along. I do what I want anyway. She likes to give orders, so we get along fine. But make sure you ask. But those are the five E's. Always ask, what? Do they have a strong identity? You know who they are. What is their education like? Formal, informal? Where did you learn things? Are your emotions? Do you have anger management skills? Some do, some don't. But those five E's pretty much explains why people act the way they do. And often we don't know that about other people. How many people know that Saddam Hussein's mother tried to abort him and just hated that child? And he grew up, there's a New Yorker piece about it, and all the anger that guy has. I'm not saying it excuses him, but it does explain maybe why he's, you know, not a pleasant person. He's killed people, no question about it. And how'd that happen? How come Saint Francis became a great saint when he was once a warrior? Why'd Howard Zinn bomb people? And now now he's almost a pacifist. Philip Berg used to bomb people Second World War. How'd he change? Everybody's got a conversion story somewhere along, either conversion to this way, positive life or negative life.
You've been listening to a talk by Colin McCarthy, founder of the Center for Teaching Peace. He spoke at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 25th. Thanks to producer George King and D.C. Indie Media for that tape.
"Are you going?" said the man at his desk. "Oh, I'm going to a new world," said the child. And he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. "I'm going to a new world," said the child, and he stood. "Oh, I'm sounding drums of war," said the man.
"I will not fight your war,"
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood.
"Oh, I will not fight your war,"
said the child, and he stood. "Oh, of your country, said the man at his desk.
Yes, I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and twill well that he stood.
I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood. True, said the man at his desk.
Yes, you lie and call it truth,
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and twere well that he stood. You lie and call it truth, said the child, and he stood.
Oh, you must be scared to die,
said the man at his desk. Oh, I'm prepared, you're scared, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and twere well that he stood. I'm prepared, and you're scared, said the child, and he stood. Said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and twere well that he stood. It's bringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood. It's ringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood.
That was The Bell by Stephen Smith, will be performing tomorrow night on the Cornell campus in Ithaca as part of a week of events against war. On Monday, February 10th, Terry Rockefeller of Peaceful Tomorrows, a group of family members of victims of the World Trade Center attacks who seek nonviolent responses to terrorism, will be appearing, along with folk singer Stephen Smith and local poets, at the Hollis E. Cornell Auditorium in Goldwin Smith Hall on the Cornell campus. The event begins at 7:30 p.m. On Tuesday, February 11th, there will be a concert of Artists United for Peace. Some of the performers will be Hank Roberts, Sim Redmond, Donna the Buffalo, Vitamin L, Women in Black, and Colleen Katow. The event begins at 7:30 and will be held in the Sage Chapel on the Cornell campus. It is free. On Wednesday, February 12th, and Thursday, February 13th, a variety of panel discussions and workshops will be held at various venues on the Cornell campus. These include topics such as pressures toward militarization in East Asia, the war on terrorism and U.S.-Latin American relations, how to hold a teach-in, and alternatives to violence. A variety of films will also be screened at various venues and times over the course of the week. For a full listing of events at the Cornell campus, on the web, visit www.geocities.com/CFJusticePeace. That's geocities.com, spelled G-E-O, cities/CFJusticePeace, standing for the Cornell Forum on Justice and Peace. These events are leading up to a massive mobilization taking place in New York City and hundreds of other cities around the world on Saturday, February 15th. Charter buses are leaving from various cities in the Finger Lakes region. From the Ithaca area, bus tickets are available at the Autumn Leaves bookstore on the Commons, or you can contact Dana Brown with the Committee on U.S.-Latin American Relations at area code 607-255-7293 or email Cuslar, C-U-S-L-A-R, at cornell.edu. There are also charter buses leaving from the Syracuse area. For more information on peace activities in the Syracuse area, contact the Syracuse Peace Council at area code 315-472-5478 or visit the website of unitedforpeace.org for general information on the demonstration in New York City. The organizers of the New York event, United for Peace and Justice, have been having some problems with the mayor. Officials in the city of New York have not been very cooperative with the organizers of Saturday's demonstration, and for some time have been refusing to issue a march permit. United for Peace is asking people to contact the city of New York to protest this effort to abridge our constitutional rights. Brian Dominic from Syracuse reported on his communication to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. This article by Brian Dominic, titled "We Will March," appeared on February 7th on the website of Z Magazine. Brian wrote, "Today I called the office of New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I left a short message for him stating that I will be marching on the streets of his town next Saturday, February 15th, in protest of a renewed war on Iraq. I also mentioned that I intend to bring 200 or 300 of my neighbors with me on buses fellow organizers and I have chartered. I made it quite clear that permit or no permit, we will march." As a U.S. invasion force builds in the Middle East, the largest, most diverse movement ever to challenge a war expands in scope and intensity throughout the world. This latest clash between the streets and the elites is at this phase neither cataclysmic nor revolutionary, but it is certainly momentous. The coordinated global actions of February 15th will almost certainly constitute the largest grassroots mobilization in history. Citing a concern that people's, quote, everyday lives would be disrupted by a massive demonstration in Manhattan, police and city officials have refused to provide protest organizers a permit to march outside the United Nations headquarters. Somehow, the preposterousness of that statement seems to be lost on authorities and most reporters. "It is the destruction and cessation of people's lives we will be marching to prevent. Disruption of lives a world over is guaranteed by the policies being aggressively pursued by the U.S. government. To oppose the elimination of lives, we will march." Bloomberg's attempt to deflate demonstration sizes by denying a permit is remarkably transparent. It has been tried before, in New York and many other cities throughout the United States. There's a significant likelihood that, as is typical, a permit will be granted at the 11th hour. Once officials are satisfied that a substantial number of would-be demonstrators have canceled their plans to participate. Ironically, if a permit is not handed down, officials will be partly responsible for transforming what would otherwise be a legally sanctioned expression of dissent into a truly massive act of civil disobedience. The remainder of that responsibility rests on the shoulders of those of us who can participate. If the state wishes to offer us a choice between silence and civil disobedience, they leave us no choice at all. If we number in the tens of thousands, they will have no capacity to stop us, and any attempt to do so would be massively detrimental to the city's image. We will look around at ourselves, at the sheer mass of protesters, and we will march. We are motivated at this point by something no politician can so easily manipulate or stifle. We are repulsed by the anti-democratic process by which our leaders have settled on the course of war. we are disgusted by the disdain their carelessness demonstrates toward the security of the Middle East and the world. We are terrified of what missiles, bombs, and bullets will do to the people of a country already tortured by more than a decade of vicious sanctions. These motivations have compelled us to pour out into the streets of countless cities, large and small, in unprecedented numbers. And as the buildup of invasion forces in the Middle East continues, a comparable escalation in the size and intensity of anti-war forces is approaching a boiling point throughout the world. Now that the government has revealed its objective to use crude repression to quell our dissent, those of us who live in the northeastern U.S. have even more reason to turn out in New York City. Instead of letting them frighten off a movement they have no practical ability to restrict, we will demonstrate their efforts to quiet us can only backfire by inspiring still more action. We will march. That was written by Brian Dominick, an anti-war organizer in Syracuse. He and other local activists have organized 5 charter buses and numerous carpools to New York City on February 15th. For information getting to New York City from Syracuse, contact the Syracuse Peace Council, area code 315-472-5478, and from Ithaca at the Autumn Leaves Bookstore. Bus tickets are available, or call 607-255-7293. To contact New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, area code 212-788-9600. That's 212-788-9600. The music used in today's program was Wasteland of the Free by Iris Dement and The Bell by Stefan Smith.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.